from KQED.
As a Republican member of Congress on the House Judiciary Committee, Tom McClintock has been on the front lines of recent impeachment proceedings. During Monday's hearings, Congressman McClintock called Democrats' case for impeachment flimsy and said their refusal to respect the will of the voters and selecting Trump threatens to collapse democracy into chaos.
This is a stunning abuse of power and a shameless travesty of justice that will stain the reputations of those responsible for generations to come.
Tom McClintock has served a decade in Congress representing California's 4th District, which spans the Sierra Nevada from Truckee to the Sequoia National Forest. He joins us now to talk about impeachment and his legislative priorities. And welcome back to Forum, Congressman McClintock. Good to have you.
Good to be back, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to begin with that quote from you we just heard, stunning abuse of power and shameless travesty of justice and so forth. And you're using words like chaos in all this. And I'm wondering really why you feel that things are coming to that kind of impasse.
Well, as I pointed out, democracy depends on exactly one thing. In every election, somebody wins, somebody loses. But democracy can only work as long as the losing side is willing to respect the decision of the voters. And as I pointed out, that's only failed us twice. It failed us in 1860 when the Democrats refused to accept the legitimate election of Abraham Lincoln. And it happened again in 2016 when they refused to accept the legitimate election of Donald Trump.
Well, democracy also includes, of course, the possibility of moving forward with articles of impeachment, which is just what went on. Let's talk about the notion you have that.
Wait just a second there. I can't let you get away with that.
It's in our Constitution, Tom.
The question of impeachment, it was debated at great length at the Constitutional Convention. And you're correct, there was a faction that sought to use maladministration, basically an undefined criteria. And it was Madison and the majority of the convention stood up and said, wait a second, what does maladministration mean? If the president can be impeached for anything, For example, Gerald Ford's famous idiotic comment that impeachment is whatever the House says it is. Well, then there's no separation of powers. The president simply serves at the pleasure of the Congress. And that's not what the founders envisioned as the architecture of our Constitution. And what's happening now is something that they feared greatly by giving impeachment to the House and the Senate. And that is this awesome power, which is literally to nullify a national election, would devolve into a partisan political weapon to be used at the whim of the Congress. And if that's the case, then the presidency becomes subordinate to the Congress, and that's exactly what Madison was warning in the Constitutional Convention.
So you see this as essentially an abuse of power by the Congress, not by the president. And I'm talking specifically about what's been described as a quid pro quo in testimony by Gordon Sondland and then also Mick Mulvaney talking about this as a quid pro quo.
Michael, I have to stop you again. When Sondland was questioned on that in cross-examination, he admitted that determination that he made was based strictly on hearsay. There was no testimony in all of the hearings of the Democrats' handpicked witnesses and with rigged rules. There was no direct testimony that the president ever ordered a quid pro quo. There was direct testimony from two witnesses that the president specifically ordered that there not be a quid pro quo.
Which was stated after, of course, the whistleblower came forward.
Again, Ron Johnson's testimony was that the president told him there was no quid pro quo back in late August and, in fact, said you're going to like my decision, meaning that he would be releasing the aid.
Well, let me ask you if you agree with the witness to the impeachment hearings. I want to talk with you about law professor Jonathan Turley, because he admitted that he had voted for Hillary Clinton. And there was a lot of outcry about you're asking who people voted for. But he essentially testified on the side of the GOP.
I'm not going to let you just drop that, Michael. The point I was making was half the nation voted for Donald Trump. Not one of the witnesses called before the committee had supported Donald Trump.
Well, that's true with respect to the witnesses. That's not necessarily true,
And that was no secret. The witnesses made all have made their antipathy toward Donald Trump.
Well, Gordon Sondland didn't have any antipathy. Gordon Sondland gave $1 million to his campaign. But let me just go to this point that I was going to make here, because Turley essentially conceded.
Gordon Sondland was not a witness before the judiciary.
No, he was not. That's correct. Yes, he was in the earlier testimony in the Intelligence Committee. But there was, according to Turley, a quid pro quo that trades public duty for public gain, and it can be an impeachable offense. Now, the use of military aid for a quid pro quo to investigate one political opponent, if proven, can be an impeachable offense. Do you agree with that?
But that's not what happened. Let's go back and just review this.
Yeah, I'm just asking you hypothetically, though, Congressman. That's all. Hypothetically.
But look, the president has, under the Constitution, all of the executive authority of our government is vested in a president of the United States. He is given plenary authority to conduct our foreign relations, and he's commanded by the Constitution to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Now, what are those laws? Well, among them is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. That makes it a crime for someone to secure a business interest in a foreign country by offering something of value to a foreign official. No one disputes that Biden's son was paid millions of dollars to sit on a board of a corrupt Ukrainian oil and gas company, Burisma, having no experience in oil or gas or the Ukraine, and that Biden threatened to withhold $1 billion in loan guarantees to the Ukrainian government unless it fired the prosecutor general, a fellow named Viktor Shokin. Now, Biden says he was merely carrying out administration policy and he knew nothing of his son's business affairs, but Shokin has testified in sworn affidavits in the European Court.
But let me, if I may, go back to my hypothetical question. If proven, would it be an impeachable offense? That's all I was asking. If proven, would that be an impeachable offense?
Michael, I'm not going to let you do what the Democrats did and suppress information that's absolutely vital to this question.
Well, you gave that information about Burisma, and I appreciate your inserting your opinion there, but I'm just asking you about a hypothetical here. If proven, would it be impeachable?
Shokin testified in sworn affidavits that he was fired specifically because he was about to question Hunter Biden about his relationship with Burisma. And his successor, by the way, soon shut down that investigation, which I think gives credence to Shokin's sworn testimony. So when the president asks the president of Ukraine for assistance in getting to the bottom of scandals that involve potentially corrupt interactions between officials in the Ukraine and the United States, he was exercising his authority and responsibility under the Constitution. And getting back to the withholding of aid, the national defense, first of all, the aid was not withheld. And as I mentioned earlier, there was no direct testimony in any of our proceedings that the president ordered that. But I would point out that the National Defense Authorization Act, which authorized aid to the Ukraine to begin with, specifically requires the administration to determine that Ukraine is taking steps to combat corruption. Now, the Secretary of Defense made such a certification in May, but that does not relieve the president of his executive authority and responsibility to review and revise those administration findings. So he was acting entirely within the law and entirely within his authority. And just because Joe Biden is a candidate for president doesn't shield him from scrutiny. Just ask candidate Trump.
Talking to Congressman Tom McClintock, and he is congressman from the 4th District, Elk Grove, member of the House Judiciary Committee. And we do welcome your involvement in the program. Let me give a number, and you can speak with us directly, raise any questions you have or comments, and you can join us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. The number again, 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. I know we got a lot of listener response, and I wanted to talk to you about your article in the Tahoe Journal and many other things as well, time permitting, even decriminalization of marijuana. But we've got a short segment here, and I want to go to the heart of the impeachment again, if I can, because just a quick question. Is it okay for the White House to ignore congressional subpoenas? This is unprecedented in number.
Well, the president didn't ignore them. What he did was went to go to court to defend his constitutional rights to maintain the confidentiality of policy discussions. That's a doctrine called executive privilege. It was first asserted by George Washington when Congress demanded documents involving the Jay Treaty, and it's been asserted, as far as I know, by every single president since then. And by the way, that's the same confidentiality that Congress enjoys in its policy discussions. What they're saying is that by defending your constitutional rights, that is ipso facto obstruction of justice and evidence of guilt. That is a concept entirely antithetical to our principles of due process.
I want to ask you also, if I may, I said earlier that you at first were not a supporter of President Trump's during the campaign and so forth. I believe that's correct. And you
in the primaries, my first choice was Scott Walker. My
right.
Second choice was Ted Cruz.
And Ted Cruz is another interesting example to me of someone who the president attacked his father and his wife, and yet he, like you and like Lindsey Graham, who attacked the president and said some very pejorative things about him, are now really totally behind him. And I wonder how that transformation – what has he done, for example, that has won you over?
Well, as I've told people since the since he received the nomination, you know, he might not have been my first or second choice, but I can sure as hell tell the difference between a fire and a fireman. And if a fireman is trying to save my house from burning down, I really don't care if sometimes he comes across as a bit of a jerk. I think that the president has moved our country dramatically in the right direction by reducing the tax and regulatory burden on our economy. He's produced one of the most impressive economic expansions in our nation's history. He's done everything he can to defend us against what I believe is one of the great mortal perils our country faces, and that is the collapse of our borders. And history warns us that countries that either cannot or will not secure their borders simply aren't around very long. So the stands that he has taken, I think, are the right ones for our country. I think that they have moved us in the right direction. And just because he comes across as a bit of a jerk is, you know, not going to enter into my calculations on whether or not I support the policies he's pursuing.
Are you bothered by the fact that he seems to believe that Ukraine was involved in meddling in our election and that somehow he is allied or at least certainly supportive in many ways of Putin?
Well, I don't think anybody disputes that Alexandra Chalupa, who was a paid consultant for the Democratic National Committee, did seek to get the Ukrainian government involved in our affairs in numerous meetings at the Ukrainian embassy, and was at least successful in getting a number of Ukrainian officials to write scathing opinion pieces against the president. That was the cause of some consternation within the Ukrainian government. He's not saying that Russia wasn't involved. What he's saying is that Ukraine was involved as well. And that was one of the things that came up in the conversation. When there are corrupt interactions between Ukrainian and American officials, the president has a right to make inquiries, and that's what he did.
We're going to take a couple calls here, and I do want to talk with you, Representative Klinok, also about a column that you wrote, an opinion piece on climate change. But let's hear first from Eric, and Eric joins us. Eric, you're on.
Hello. Thank you for taking the question. Three times you asked the senator to answer a hypothetical question about impeachment, and three times or more the senator digressed. And
let me just correct you. Tom McClintock is a congressman, not a senator, but go ahead.
Congressman. So I would like the congressman, instead of going off on tangents, to just answer the simple hypothetical question that he asked you about impeachment, and I will take my answer offline.
All right. Thank you for the call, Tom McClintock.
To be very clear, I completely reject the premise of the question. That is not what the president did. That's not what the evidence shows.
Well, I asked you, if the evidence did show that, would you say that that would be a reason to impeach a president, Democrat or Republican? That was the spirit of what I asked you.
And I'm not going to answer a hypothetical question that where the implication is that's what the president did. That's not what the president did.
All right. Let me get another caller on here then. Dale joins us next. Dale, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm just blown away by that last answer. Once again, he went for number four by not answering it. It's just mind-blowing what it's opposite day for the Republican Party. My original comment was just that I'm really tired of hearing about the reversal of an election. It's not like the election just happened. He's been president for 3 years. We've been watching it unfold. It's no reversal of an election. What else can you do in impeachment? On the way out the door?
Okay, I thank you for that comment. I let the comment stand unless you want to respond, Congressman.
We first heard calls by Democrats for the president's impeachment within days of the 2016 election. That was more than 2 months before he was even sworn into office so that he could do anything that could be impeached. The very day after the 2018 election made Jerry Nadler the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, he was overheard on the train back to Washington plotting the impeachment strategy. The Democrats have used one pretext after another in attempting to support that scheme, and they've all fallen apart. It wasn't just the Russian collusion narrative, which is now completely discredited. We were also being told of everything from Stormy Daniels to tax returns to one of the Harvard professor that came before our committee had actually advocated that the president be impeached about 2 months after the election because of his tweets.
And that was Noah Feldman, just for the record.
Noah Feldman, who, by the way, testified under oath before to the committee that he'd been an impeachment skeptic until he saw the president's conversation with Ukraine. We went back and looked. He was advocating the president's impeachment over tweets less than 2 months after the president took office. So my point is that this is a very long established pattern. They have searched for one excuse after another. And I think that calls into question the sincerity with which they are proceeding.
Let me read a question from a listener named Bob. He says, can Representative McClintock make explicit which witnesses in favor of the president were specifically proposed by Republicans and were denied by committee and not the whistleblower whose anonymity is protected by law?
Actually, the whistleblower's anonymity is not protected by law. The inspector general is not allowed to release his name. But the fact of the matter is the whistleblower statute under the Inspector General of the Intelligence Communities doesn't include the president or the White House, so it was not a whistleblower complaint in a legal sense to begin with. And I think it's very important that we find out why did the whistleblower, among other things, conceal his interactions with Schiff's office on the whistleblower complaint.
Since you mentioned the Inspector General, I've got to ask you, Attorney General Barr has pretty much tried, I think, in fact, is trying, is a good way to put it, to discredit the report, and he's got a number of people on his side on this.
We're speaking about two different inspector generals.
I'm speaking about Horowitz now, the inspector general who spoke this morning, and the report that came out, which was essentially exonerating what had been contended by many Republicans, not all Republicans, but many Republicans early on in terms of the campaign going back to Carter Page and FISA and so forth. The attorney general seems to be really indicting the whole process and the report itself. Are you on board on that with the attorney general?
First of all, I think you've completely mischaracterized what he said. the attorney general or the inspector general, I think, is thoroughly and completely documented how the FISA process was abused. There were 17 omissions, errors, and a more simple word would be lies that were used before the FISA court to spy on a presidential campaign that was entirely without basis. The area where I think the attorney general differs with the inspector general, and by the way, the U.S. attorney John Durham has released a similar statement, is on whether opening the investigation was justified to begin with. What the inspector general has said is that he saw no bias among the officials involved. If you read the actual emails that he reveals in his report, they are dripping with venomous, hostile statements about Donald Trump. To me, it doesn't pass the smell test to say, yes, they had all of these absolutely vitriolic things to say about Donald Trump in their communications with one another, but that played no part in 17 errors and omissions that were made before the FISA court. I don't buy that. I just it doesn't jive with our own human nature.
I guess is Tom McClintock, Congressman of the 4th District,
Elk Grove.
The other
thing I would say is the predication of the case. That's being looked into by Durham, who has a much wider, and by the way, Barr has the same perspective, much wider view than Horowitz. Horowitz is only allowed to look at what was going on specifically within the Department of Justice among employees who are still there.
But Durham was named by Barr, of course.
Durham has a much broader authority to look into what was going on in our intelligence agencies at the same time. And I think when he finishes his investigation, we'll have a much more complete picture of everything that was going on in this whole Russian collusion hoax.
I wanted to ask you, as I said earlier, about climate change, because in many people's minds, this is the existential crisis that we face globally, and certainly here in California, many people linking the wildfires and the difficulties we've been having on many fronts to climate change. And in the Tahoe Daily Tribune, you did an opinion piece, which I read, and I wanted to bring it up to you and get your response, because essentially you said the sky is not falling, and it's Chicken Little type stuff that we're hearing from many people about climate change, and it needs more scientific research. And I'm wondering about that in light of the fact that you have multiple studies that have been published, I'm sure you're aware, in peer-reviewed scientific journals. 97% or more actively publishing climate scientists agree that trends over the past century are extremely likely due to human activities. Is there something that scientists could say that would change your mind on this?
First of all, I think that 97% figure has been completely and thoroughly debunked. And even if it were true, science is not a vote of the majority. It is a rigorous application of fact and observations.
You can find that figure on NASA's website, Congressman, by the way.
Well, I understand that. But if you also want to do a quick run through the Internet, you will find many, many peer-reviewed scholarly papers that question the extent to which this is, as you put it, an existential crisis. The fact is the climate's been changing for 4.5 billion years. We're currently about 12,000 years into the current interglacial period. Interglacial periods last between 10 and 15,000 years, and they are punctuated by 100,000-year periods of glaciation. And so we're taking one tiny little segment of data, and I think failing to look at the broader implications of climate change throughout the history of this planet.
Let me get another caller on. Greg, that's you. Thanks for waiting. Join us with Tom McClintock. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say, first of all, I'm really grateful for this program. In my first election ever, I voted for Ronald Reagan. My entire voting time has been, you know, every time I vote, I am holding Republican fiscal values. And the recent events and, quite frankly, this conversation really secures for me the reason why I think there are two different parties. There's the party of old and there's the party now. And it really secures for me the level of insult that I feel is put upon voters with the spin and the reframing and the gaslighting that's making me not only decide to leave the party, and while I won't call myself a Democrat, I feel like my party has to be, for the sake of integrity, more of an anti-Republican ballot, which is not about the values or the fiscal responsibility, but it's about the insult and the lack of the commitment to unintelligence that I have to reject moving forward for the sake of our not only our country, but quite frankly, for the well-being of our society and our earth.
Greg, let me thank you for that call. And actually, I want to pick up on Greg's point about fiscal responsibility, if I could. Well, I know you want to respond to what he said in content, but you have always been very much a champion of fiscal responsibility. I think I can say that because I've known your work for years and you've been on the program a number of times. What about, just let's not get partisan in this, but what about the fact that the deficit has ballooned so exponentially in this present administration? I mean, are traditional old guard Republicans just supposed to deny that and not see it?
No, absolutely not. It is absolutely inexcusable. I was on the budget committee for 8 years, warning about the dangers to our economy that these massive deficits are posing for our future. Right now, they're masked by a remarkable economic expansion, but they're still there. The only defense I can offer of Republicans is Democrats of only criticism is that we're not spending enough money fast enough. So, you know, from that standpoint, I agree with you. But I have to remark one thing about that last caller's statement that unfortunately has become a staple of political discourse today. Listen to what he said. He says, "I disagree with you because you're an idiot, because you're unintelligent." It's impossible to have a civil conversation when, you know, the two sides denigrate each other like that. And, you know, that's one of the things I find the most disturbing over developments over the past 10 or 15
years. Isn't it disturbing, though, when you hear the president talking about Democrats all being scum and language like that?
Talk about civility. I have often said that I wish the president would channel a little more of his inner Ronald Reagan and talk more of policy and less of personalities. But blaming one for the other doesn't wash either. It's a threat to civil discourse, whoever is doing it.
Well, here's John who wants to know, if President Trump had the authority to withhold aid, why did he do it secretly through unofficial channels instead of publicly?
Well, first of all, he has the authority to do it and did it. I wouldn't call it through unofficial channels. He has the authority to withhold aid under the NDAA, but he didn't withhold that aid. He may, again, as I've said, there's been no direct testimony that at any time did he link aid with cooperation with an investigation. And ultimately, he released that funding and made that clear. He was to Senator Johnson. He was planning to release that funding good week or so before the before the whistleblower complaint became public.
And Congressman, I'm going to go to one more comment from Edie, who says, please remind the representative that President Trump did not win the popular vote. It's not the will of the people that Trump is in power. And it's true, he did win the Electoral College, but not the popular vote.
Well, that's a direct attack on our constitutional institutions. We have an Electoral College to assure that the rural parts of our country are not completely dominated by the urban parts. And, you know, that's part of the fundamental architecture of our form of government. That's why we have a U.S. Senate, and that's why we have an Electoral College. And an attack on that is an attack upon the fundamental architecture of our Constitution.
Congressman, good to have you with us. I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's California Congressman Tom McClintock, a Republican on the House Judiciary Committee, which is conducting the impeachment hearings. And when we return, we're going to talk to a couple of twins who are involved in, who have a vision of Black Joy in San Francisco. You'll want to hear that. It's up ahead. And we'll also talk with Valerie Stimmick about astrotourism.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.